I decided that I liked flying, and I didn't like hiking and marching and carrying packs. So I looked around and joined the Marine Corps. I didn't even know the Marine Corps had aviators or aviation. But and there were six of us from the hometown that joined at the same time. And so we went down to Long Beach, California, and signed up and went through what they call elimination training. And I went through training at Corpus Christi and became a second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps. In those days, to be an aviator was, oh man, you got to wear leather jackets and let everybody in the bar know you were a flyer and that kind of stuff. But anyhow, we got assigned to what they call an observation unit, and it's a squadron of about 50 pilots. And as the war came along, they misled us. We went to war. Of course, none of us had planned on that, and we were assigned, three of us were assigned to the same outfit, and we ended up in Quantico, Virginia, and then orders, about a month later, we found ourselves on the high seas going to someplace. No, we didn't know where or how or anything, so we went, and finally, one morning at 3 o'clock, they woke us all up and put us in, made us go over the side in the old Pacific and heave and thrust, and we landed on the island of Samoa, Tutuila, Samoa. And then that was our first taste of war. We flew patrols out of there till December. And then I went, in December, we were transferred, a group of us, and we became fighter pilots in the war. It was just starting in the Solomon Islands, and a place that you probably heard of, Guadalcanal. And that was the first real offensive action we had taken in the war. We were fighting defensive until then. So we went through and went to, from Samoa to Guadalcanal, which is a place to forget if you can. Weather is bad and hard to fly in and all that. So, but we stayed there and we flew patrol out of there and also then the Japs started wanting to recapture it. The ground marines had captured it from the Japs, and we were there and going to take it back. And so our air war really started in Samoa. I went through there and they decided they didn't need pilots flying observation, VMO. That's where you have all sorts of tricky things you do with. In those days, we'd throw down notes. And finally, we learned how to use a radio, and then we go by voice. But to this day, I still sit in the airplane differently than we would have without that. Experience. Well, we ended up in the fighter squadron, and then we started flying against the Japanese. Well, that was kind of thrilling, and that part of my plans. To make a long story short, over the period of time, I shot down two Japanese jet airplanes. It got pretty hot. That was the only aggressive action the United States had taken to that point. I put in my tour, and then they sent us back. Well, all this time, we had things working on our health. The top of that that's what the old tropics was. You had malaria, all sorts of things. And I got a good dose of malaria, and then our time was elapsed, and they relieved us. We were, at that point, we'd been overseas over a year.
Were there moments during World War II that really stand out to you? Pivotal moments for you?
Well, going from just the land-based pilot that flew out over the ocean and back, I became fighter pilot in a hurry, and that means once in a while you'd get enemy coming in. At that time, we were nothing, and the Japanese were loaded. So that was, I'd say, the pivotal point right there. But I would, you know, you take off each day, you didn't know if you were coming back. I lost lots of friends.
So what was the carrier that you were on when you were out there?
The USS Franklin. And it was hit by a kamikaze. And you could take off in the morning from the plane, and when you get back, it's not your ship is down, sunk. That's what happened in many times to the naval people. They'd be out flying and come back, no place to land. Then you'd try to find another carrier that would accept you aboard.
And was it kamikazed while you were out there?
Yeah, it was hit. It was bombed and hit. I wasn't on the ship then. I was a staff officer. I forgot to mention that. Living ashore. But all the boys that I had trained were aboard. And I lost a lot of friends that day. And we spent 1 year in Mojave training as a... You ever been to Mojave, California? You can imagine 50 or 60 young characters landing in that place. So we were well acquainted with each other, but real friends, and we're still friends. Those of us are still alive. By the way, not only having been a lifelong friend, but he ended up being my brother-in-law. He married my wife's sister. Naomi and I got married, and he decided, well, if you were going to get married, I might as well get married too. So he married her, and he was killed over there. So those things are the ones that really shock you, you know, when it gets personal.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a field and years that are a long time ago, but were very complicated in living. You're with us today, you're this, tomorrow, you're something else. And you have to realize that people my age most of us hadn't even been in an airplane when I first started.
Flying was so new that pioneer aviator and media star Charles Lindbergh spent time with Colonel Bryson's flight crew to get some tips on flying.
Well, we flew with Lindbergh a couple of times. He came and wanted to know how he handled this particular situation. He was working for an aircraft manufacturer, and he wanted to know the problems we were finding with the airplane, you know. And so you go from being a farm boy or just a plain, ordinary slob and find yourself asking the greatest aviator in the world how to fly an airplane, or are you telling him how? That was a strange thing. He had to find out from us.
This is Allie Lightfoot, and you're tuned into Local Motion on KVNF. I've been speaking with retired Colonel Robert Bryson, who was a fighter pilot in World War II. Bryson married his wife Naomi while on duty, and they had 7 children. After his service in the military ended, he and his family moved to Paonia to farm.
It was a good life to live after you've lived it, but it's a little rough on the family and picking them up and moving all the time. And the wife had to take care of them. Being Catholic, we had lots of kids. Now we have lots of grandkids. Our first child was born and deaf. And at that time, there's no place, other about 2 or 3 places in the United States that you could be trained. Well, you couldn't be a Marine officer. And be restricted to where you go. So I got out at the end of the war. And in order to make enough to money to feed my child, and as it happened, pretty soon more and more and more children, I joined the reserve. And no sooner had I settled down, and I was a squadron commander in the reserve in Glenview, Illinois, then they recalled us, and we were back on active duty. And so I said, well, if you're going to keep me going back and forth, well, you might as well keep me. So I stayed in. And I put in, I stayed in and was promoted from up through the ranks rapidly because the Marine Corps was expanding. I ended up the war as a major. I was recalled for Korea. We went to Korea, and then we stayed on and on, trained. And the kids kept coming and growing, and I finally ended up being an expert in reserve matters because I was a reserve on active duty. Ended up that I got out. I'd made full colonel and was in line to be the head reserve. I was the senior reserve on active duty. But you get pretty tired after 30 years or so of military thing. And so we came out and decided we'd call it quits. I retired and came here and been here ever since. We bought this little farm and have worked on it ever since till it's what we want. It sits here and we're just happier and pigging stuff.
I'm sure there are drastic differences between modern day war and during World War II.
Well, it used at the start of the war, the average civilian wasn't involved at all. They gave them, you know, one told them to go get a job in a factory or something like that. But now it involves everybody. You don't know a lot of it, but you have to pay taxes that support services. And it's an expensive way to work, to say to protect the country. You have no, of course, as youngsters, that didn't mean anything to us. You live for the group that you're with, and the rest of them can take care of themselves. So then we all end up heroes and get medals and all that stuff. But the war is these groups of squadrons that I belong to and the people that were in them and made them. But then we all end up loving Japan. At the end of the war, you go over and take a hot bath and talk to the Japanese. And being from California, I'd known Japanese all my life. And I was spent a lot of time writing to my Japanese schoolmates that from California. And those that weren't in the service were in those camps that they built. Actually, I look back at all of this. It's gobbledygook, I know, but it's the start of the modern countries as we've changed our ideas.
Do you think that the military is treated well? Do you think our soldiers are treated well, or do you think that they could be treated better, including how our government treats them as well?
Oh, yeah. They have to treat us well. They're the ones that go execute all their cockamamie plans. No, it's fine now. But when I first started, people didn't even know about aviation or particularly military aviation. No, we were treated fine. That's why the population is still. I can't think of it. Why any problems we had with the civilians? Mm-hmm. We were respected usually when they find out you were a fighter pilot, because in those days very, very few people had even flown in an airplane. So,
were you ever in a plane when it got hit?
I didn't get a bullet, if that's what you mean, but I had a couple crack ups. Is weather, and can you imagine taking off in the dark with the lights from one Jeep and going out and flying and keep flying and it's dark and you've got 300 or 400 miles to get back to the carrier? There's no thrill or hero in that. And the people just started learning because of the air wars that were going on at the time with Germany and the Air Force boys. We all had similar experiences. You'd go into the, at the first of the war, you'd go into a bar or a restaurant, you couldn't pay a bill. But then pretty soon everybody and their brother next door, we were tied up with it, and we weren't so famous. But I think we were in a developing time, and so you can say that I'm one of the early aviators, military aviators.
Do you look fondly upon your experience when you were in the military?
Oh, yeah. The most dangerous thing in the world is boredom. And in aviation, there's no chance for that. You look at the mirror and you listen to the radio and you listen all sorts of little things that caution you to be careful. You're not here alone. It was always a kick in the head to be able to go get back and take off your helmet, and first thing you do is reach for a pack of cigarettes, which were free at the time, then start talking, the hands start going, showing all the maneuvers that you went through. But there's also the bad moments. We're the ones that this brother and I was talking about. Well, he was killed, and I was reported as being one being killed, and not him. So that was the night that the Japanese hit Chicago. A cruiser of ours was sinking, and we went out to, we say, cover it to keep it from getting hit more. You get back, and you're thankful that you did, and it's a thrill. But you're having experiences that the average person will never have.